Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, we've been covering the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. On Monday, we asked Iraqis to reflect back on 10 years and share their personal stories. On Tuesday, we talked about the true costs of the war, $6 trillion over the next four decades, according to the Cost of War Project. The anniversary got extensive coverage in the media, and many outlets did their own reflecting, mostly on the op-ed pages. The International Herald Tribune headline, "The Legacies of Iraq in Alien Press and an Invade or Nothing Foreign Policy." The LA Times, "Iraq War 10th Anniversary, a Dark Mark for News Media." The Huffington Post headline, "Washington Post editorial page misses Iraq War Anniversary." And here's the lead of that piece. In the months leading up to the Iraq War, The Washington Post ran 27 editorials in favor of the invasion, according to account by veteran PBS journalist Bill Moyers. This week, around the 10-year anniversary of the war, The Washington Post has yet to print any editorials or columns on the subject. Rick Holmes, opinion editor for the Daily News, writes, quote, "Americans were not celebrating on Tuesday the 10-year anniversary. No cakes, no parties, no parades. Truth be told, we'd rather not think about it. But anniversaries are a good reason to remember bad things as well as good. And the invasion of Iraq, along with the politics that came before and the disasters that followed, should never be forgotten. The invasion was launched from a platform of lies doled out by members of an administration bent on war and amplified by media that had been cheerleading for the USA since 9/11 and had mostly stopped asking tough questions," end quote. In 2008, the Center for Public Integrity and the Fund for Independence asked this question: did the Bush administration lie its way to war in Iraq? And it found 935 lies. Over at The Atlantic, we found a piece that focused on the resentment and mockery aimed at anti-war protesters, one of a few outlets to focus on the anti-war movement 10 years ago. So how are the media reflecting this week, and how should they? Joining us to talk about this is Sadhar Issa. She is former Baghdad Bureau correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and she joined us on Monday when we asked Iraqis to reflect back. Hi, Sadhar. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you. We are also joined by Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent for The Guardian of London. Martin was based in Baghdad from 2005 to 2011. He is now based in Beirut, where he is extensively covering the situation in Syria. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Good to have you. And we're joined by Robert Dreyfus, contributing editor at The Nation, contributing writer at Mother Jones, and a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. Robert's latest piece for The Nation is called "WMD in Syria. Here we go again." He writes, "Hawks, neocons, liberal interventionists, and others, truth be told, in Washington, nearly everyone except President Obama himself seems to want to get involved militarily in Syria. The latest bugaboo, WMD. Haven't we heard that someplace before, say 10 years ago?" Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Great to be here.
Nice to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Martin, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, it's been good to see a lot of coverage in Iraq over the past week. There's been so many months, if not a couple of years, where there's barely been anything. But one piece that did catch my attention amongst the generally good work that was done by a lot of people was Ned Parker's piece in the World Policy Journal, which was a long and authoritative look at the Maliki government that the Americans did back from 2006 onwards. It was a really penetrating, terrific insight into the psychology of the man and the state that Maliki is building, which is disturbingly rather resembling the state that Saddam built in the old days. And I think that work deserves a lot of credit.
All right. Well, kudos to Ned Parker, and we'll put a link on our website right after the show. Thank you for that. And what about you, Robert? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I don't remember now the author of the piece, but there was a great piece in the New York Times this week about the Israeli Iron Dome rocket system, which has been ostensibly installed at the cost of about $1 billion by the United States in particular to protect Israel against rockets launched from Gaza and from Lebanon. And basically what the piece showed is that the system, which has been greatly lauded by all kinds of people, including President Obama, who just visited Israel, it doesn't work. And it cited a number of experts in missile defense and elsewhere who've studied the videotapes of these rockets exploding up in the sky and determined that maybe as few as 5 to 10% of them actually hit their targets. So I thought that was a really important piece that shows something of a gigantic boondoggle that maybe makes Israelis feel safer, but which, you know, isn't working.
And why doesn't it work?
Well, it doesn't work for the same reason that a lot of these missile defense systems don't work. It's very difficult to intercept a missile that's coming from the sky, you know, in flight. And so it's designed to explode near the rocket that it's targeting. And then pieces of that explosion are designed to shatter the rocket. But what they found is that in many cases, if it does, in fact, explode near its target, it doesn't destroy the warhead. And so the warhead then continues along its trajectory or simply drops straight down, but in either case can do a lot of damage. So, it's somewhat of a technical issue, but I think it's an important story.
Right. Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because the other big story this week was President Obama's trip to Israel and the West Bank, and we will be talking about the coverage of that along with U.S. aid and the weapons. So thank you for that. Kudos to the New York Times from Robert Dreyfus. And what about you, Sadha? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
To tell you the truth, I would like to say something about the news from this side of the fence. From the Iraqi media. In the Iraqi media, unfortunately, the 10th anniversary of the occupation passed almost without any mention. But you will find that on the, the social media, everyone is talking about it, reflecting backwards, saying what has been accomplished and what has the Iraqi authority been able to accomplish even after the American forces, combat forces withdrew. And generally speaking, you will find that the official media, the well-known media, there are no headlines, there is no spotlight, nothing like that has occurred. And that in itself is a story. The people are so immersed with things that are happening today. This day doesn't seem to have any meaning anymore.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think the anniversary didn't get much coverage in Iraq?
Because of the current situation. The current situation, we are sitting on a time bomb. Many people are saying perhaps these are the first signs of division of the country. Some of the people in authority are projecting that the people who are protesting, even though their protests are peaceful so far, will be attacking Baghdad soon. And there are heightened tensions, and people are truly afraid. When you go to the streets, if you are on a minibus or if you are a street, especially if you are in a Shiite majority neighborhood, you will find comments like, why does Maliki bomb them all and rid us of them? Or what are we going to do when they come and attack and kill all of us? And things like that. So believe me, the Iraqi people at this time have their minds somewhere else. It is this time bomb we are sitting on that is not getting enough serious attention from the government in order to resolve it. People are afraid.
On Tuesday, Sadha, there was about 20 attacks in Iraq, which killed at least 65 people. It seems like the number of bombings are increasing as of late. What do you make of what's currently happening?
This is, of course, something that always happens at a time of conflict. When the when the politicians have conflict between them, it always opens a way for we call them germs to get into the wounds. So what is happening is, of course, a lot of this violence is political. There are some political sides who wish to have the people afraid. Why? because a lot of the people who came to power riding the wave of sectarian strife. The Shiite politicians told the Shiites, we will protect you from the Sunnis. And the Sunni politicians told the Sunnis that we will protect you from the Shiites, etc. People who have risen to power on such assertions need their following to be afraid in order for them to rally around their leadership. And so when there is conflict between the leaders of the political blocs or the leaders of the sects, you will find this kind of activity, this kind of violence in the streets. Of course, who pays the price? It is the poor Iraqi person on the innocent on the street. It is the grocer. It is the security person. It is the person who's going to the library. It is the person who's going to school. It is never the people who are behind or are the reason behind this kind of violence. It is political in nature.
That is Sarah Issa, former Baghdad bureau correspondent for McClatchy. And her line from Baghdad today is excellent because she's on a journalist's phone. When we tried to reach Iraqis on Monday, we couldn't because the phone lines are so bad. And Sarah will be with us for another 10 minutes or so. So if you'd like to talk about coverage of the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion, now would be a good time to call. What really struck you about coverage in the lead up to the war, and then what struck you as we are seeing some outlets, many outlets actually, take a look back at what they learned from that coverage? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. How do you think the media should reflect? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Robert Dreyfus, contributing editor at The Nation, and Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent for The Guardian of London. And Martin, you have been in and out of Baghdad over the years, extensively covering the war. What goes through your mind when you hear Sadha, who's currently in Baghdad, saying that we're sitting on a time bomb?
I think she's right. I don't think I've seen anything in the last 3 or 4 years which has gone towards, you know, reconsolidating or even building this nation state of Iraq. I do think there is a real risk of partition along sectarian lines in that country. The institutions remain brittle. The state itself remains weak. The outlook from the political leaders is absolutely sectarian. And there doesn't seem to be much of a will or even a desire to look beyond the sectarian outlook. I mean, the nation state of Kurds, of Sunnis, of Shias, of Christians, of Ismailis, which was assembled together when the heartland of Arabia was carved into nation states at the end of the Ottoman Empire, it doesn't look as though it can hold it together in the long run. The crisis in Syria is no doubt at all. It's pouring flames on the fire in terms of Iraq, in terms of Lebanon as well. The province of Anbar in the west, which is largely Sunni, and bear in mind that the Sunnis were the losers in the invasion. They did have control then. They certainly don't now. They are uniting with the Sunnis of Syria, who, by and large, drive the opposition against Bashar al-Assad. Maliki's government has united with the Alawite government of Damascus, of Bashar al-Assad's government. So Maliki's Shia government has formed an alliance there which goes straight back to Iran. So not only is the sectarian dynamic playing out in Iraq, but it's playing out right across the region, and Iraq is very much in the thick of it and in a very, very brittle state of affairs from where I look.
And elaborate on that a bit, Martin. How is the conflict in Syria complicating the current situation in Iraq?
Well, there's no doubt that the Sunnis, who, as I said, lost a lot in Baghdad in 2003, have been waiting for a moment to claw back some of those lost gains. And they are looking for the power and the patronage and the influence that they once had. The uprising in Syria, which was a popular uprising, which started, you know, along the very same themes that rumbled through North Africa, and they were dignity, self-determination, many other things like that, has become increasingly sectarian in nature. The opposition in Syria is primarily Sunni. Anbar province, which borders Iraq, has seen this as an opportunity to press its own cause. There is an extremist fringe to the opposition in Syria. It's certainly not an extremist uprising, but there is a fringe which is becoming increasingly influential, and we are seeing some groups in Iraq who have never conceded that the power base that they once had is gone forever. They are seeing this is their moment to push on back against the Maliki government in particular. Maliki has been on the record in recent weeks as saying if the opposition win in Syria, then there will be a civil war in Iraq. So his backing for Assad, who is backed very heavily by Iran, is emphatic. I think battle lines to some extent have been drawn along a very volatile sectarian fault line.
That is Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent for The Guardian of London. And Robert Dreyfus, your latest piece in The Nation is called WMD in Syria. Here we go again. Talk about how what Martin just described is playing out in the U.S. media, and specifically the angle that you took about how you write hawks and neocons and others are wanting to get involved militarily in Syria. Robert? Did we
lose? Well, I would say that the United States, has generally approached the Middle East from a know-nothing standpoint. In other words, most of what we've done in the region, we've done in a blundering kind of way. Certainly that was true going into Iraq. We don't understand how that part of the world works, and it's somewhat amazing to me that American politicians, have the temerity to go around Washington saying that, they think this or that is, best for the Middle East, when it's a part of the world that they don't understand at all. I guess I would start by saying that President Obama did something remarkable last year when virtually his entire national security apparatus, the CIA, the State Department, in the person of Hillary Clinton, the Pentagon, and the military brass, all got together to develop a plan to go into Syria and aid the rebels directly. And Obama overruled them. It's very unusual that you see a president overruling the entire national security establishment. So that's why I said in that piece that you quoted that Obama is pretty much the only one in Washington who seems to have a sensible approach to the crisis in Syria. On the other hand, you have the ridiculous situation where the CIA is aiding both sides of the conflicts. In Jordan, according to the New York Times, the CIA is training Syrian rebels. They're on the ground in Jordan, training fighters to go into battle against Assad. Whereas in Iraq, they're helping Maliki battle the same brand of Sunni-led, Al-Qaeda-leaning rebels in Iraq that we're supposedly aiding in Syria. So how is it that we're aiding the Sunni rebels in Syria while we're trying to put them down in Iraq? It's just one in a long, long line of absurd paradoxes about the way the United States has approached this part of the world. Way back in 2003, Chaz Freeman, who was ambassador to Saudi Arabia, told me, "We didn't invade Iraq, we invaded the Iraq of our dreams." And that's absolutely right. We didn't have a clue about how Iraq worked. But by intervening in the way we did, we took a country where the religious and ethnic groups had pretty much lived in neighborhood harmony. There was a great deal of intermarriage. And we turned it into a sectarian and ethnic hellhole. And that's something that the United States has to own up to, that we destroyed the social fabric of an entire nation And for what? For nothing.
Well, we're going to spend a chunk of time talking about how the media really enabled the Bush administration and the Democrats who voted for the war to invade Iraq. But Robert, when you look at the reflections, I mean, the LA Times, Iraq War 10th anniversary, a dark mark for news media. What have the media really learned in 10 years?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the media takes its cue, unfortunately, from the government. You know, when Obama came into office, he deliberately chose not to look back for political reasons. He chose not to look back at the origin of the Iraqi war, at the policy of illegal detention and torture. And so in trying to turn the page on that era, I think the president signaled that, you know, we should all not talk about that. We should sweep it under the rug. And now, obviously, I think that was a huge mistake, and I blame the media once again for taking their cue from the White House in saying, well, there's no point in really, you know, reopening that that can of worms. And so far, they, you know, they've, I mean, they had their retrospectives and so forth and so on. But I think, sadly, in reading a lot of them, I saw the same people who I reported on 10 years ago who were promoting the war speaking once again as if they hadn't done anything wrong. And these are people who should be drummed out of the pundit core and drummed out of the think tanks. And yet they're still treated as respectable spokespeople for their point of view. And I think that's just a terrible commentary on our ability to look backwards and think, you know, what happened 10 years ago and how we got there.
And that is Robert Dreyfus, contributing editor for The Nation magazine. And Sadha, before we get a break, I just wanted you to jump in quickly because the International Herald Tribune reports that the New York Times published a series of exaggerated articles about weapons by Judith Miller on its front page. At the same time, editors at Knight Ridder, for example, really questioned the administration's claims about these weapons. Knight Ridder, now McClatchy, was one of the only newspapers that really questioned the Bush administration claim, for which they've received so many awards in the last 10 years. Now, you're a former Baghdad correspondent for McClatchy. What are your quick thoughts before we go to break on that?
The quick thoughts, I will tell you just one thing very small. In the end of August of 2010, Joe Biden came to Baghdad to a ceremony to end combat operations. When he was standing up there, he had a speech. The first things he said was, of course, he looked at the all the casualties, the American casualties and the things like that, and he talked about them. And then he said, when I look around and see the awesome, awesome accomplishments that has taken place here, then I think it is worth it. And at that time, for 6 months, the Iraqi political parties were trying to form a government, and we had no government. 6 months after elections, and we had no air force. And we had no security on the ground.
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking about media coverage of Iraq, and in about 10 minutes, we will talk about President Obama's trip to Israel. It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is always better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, comment, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. KALW is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Sedaris will visit San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House on Sunday, May 5th, for an evening of all new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com. davidsedarisontour.com.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll speak with Mark Kitchell, director of the documentary A Fierce Green Fire that explores 50 years of the global grassroots environmental movement. How has activism around environmental issues changed and what's in store for the future? Try to see the film over the weekend and then join us on Monday. Again, it's called A Fierce Green Fire. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we are talking about coverage of the 10-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The anniversary got extensive coverage this week. Many outlets did their own reflecting. The L.A. Times, Iraq War, 10th anniversary, a dark mark for news media. The International Herald Tribune, the legacies of Iraq, an ailing press, and an invade or nothing foreign policy. So how are the media reflecting, and how do you think they should reflect? What really stood out for you this week, and how are you reflecting after 10 years of media coverage and the lead up to the invasion of Iraq? The toll free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. In about 10 minutes, we'll talk about coverage of President Obama's trip to Israel and the West Bank, and we'd love to hear from you on that. And then also, if you saw a story this week that you think deserves more attention, you can give us a call or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Robert Dreyfus, contributing editor at The Nation, contributing writer at Mother Jones. His latest piece for The Nation, WMD in Syria. Here we go again. Martin Chulov is Middle East correspondent for The Guardian of London. He's reported extensively from Baghdad over the years. He's now based in Beirut, and he's covering what's happening on the ground in Syria. And Sadha Issa is former Baghdad bureau correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And Sadha, before I bring in Martin, I wanted you to finish your thought, because we were talking about how Knight Ridder, which is now McClatchy, received major awards for really looking at and questioning the Bush administration's justification for invading Iraq.
Yes, the point that I wanted to make in short is that when Mr. Biden said awesome accomplishment, when the situation on the ground was so bad, he was depending completely, as do many other politicians, on the ignorance of the people of the situation. This is the responsibility of the press, of course. It is the media. And it is true that a lot of the time, unfortunately, the spotlight moves with a cue from authority. So now the spotlight has moved away from Iraq for a long time now. For this anniversary, it has come back. Maybe people, like, how do you say, it is like a wake-up call. People can come and look and see what the situation is on the ground. What, is there an accomplishment? Was it a futile thing? And also, there is a lesson to be learned here. I don't know, maybe for the American administration, for the American people, maybe they can influence. As my colleague spoke a few minutes ago, it is sometimes surprising how such a big step can be taken in a region that is not well understood. So that the steps that are taken and the things that are done are not thought out properly, and the results are very, very terrible, because this action on the side of the U.S. In the region has not only destabilized Iraq, it has destabilized Iraq, it has destabilized the whole region. It has turned, if you have a good look, it has turned the authority in this region away from secular into a more almost a theocracy, governments giving rise to extremists. This is something no one wants. Neither does the American administration, nor do the people here, nor do the people anywhere. No one wants violence. No one wants a division between the people. Unfortunately, this is what we have gained. Not only Iraq, but in the region, as you can see in Syria, as you can see even in Egypt, as you can see. It has given rise to all these things.
And Martin Chulov, you have reported from Baghdad extensively over the years. What lessons do you think the media have learned 10 years after the invasion? Martin, are you with us?
Few days or so, as a lot of media outlets have revisited Iraq, and as I've said earlier, they disappeared for months, if not years. But now there does appear to be some sort of a collective introspective examination of just how accepting we are of things that governments tell us, and we're certainly getting that on Syria, as you know, some similar sort of themes connected to this story that's taking place now. You know, we have an oppressive dictator. We have the specter of chemical weapons. We have persecution. We have people sitting on the sidelines calling for intervention. Others saying not to. I do think that. What took place in Iraq and the fact that the case for invasion was built on a fallacy is very much hanging over the coverage of Syria. There's a lot more caution now than there was 10 years ago in examining what we're being told about things that are taking place on the ground or any imminent threats. Certainly in my newsroom, we proceed very, very cautiously when it comes to I guess going after any hard news lines on Syria, and I very significantly feel the shadow of Iraq hanging over what we do, and we're not alone in that. I think a lot of our competitors, a lot of our colleagues, are going through a similar process.
And what about the major differences between the U.S. media and the European media, for example? What really strikes you about the differences
on Iraq?
Yes.
Well, I think I think perhaps the U.S. media, especially the establishment media, the New York Times and a couple of others, were very seriously burned on Iraq. And, you know, that's something which has damaged their brand to some extent. You mentioned the Washington Post earlier as well. The New York Times took out an ad, I think, back in 2007, which was effectively saying we over-egged it on many things. And, you know, that's something which has haunted them as an institution for the years since. So I think they're going through a very similar process to what we're going through, and that is don't be accepting, you know, lift up stones, speak truth to power, you know, don't become part of the establishment per se. Always stay on the sidelines, grizzling and snarling and being skeptical. They went through a pretty intensive re-examination over the last 10 years, and I think that they've the lessons have been well learnt when it comes to covering Syria, certainly from what I can see. But, you know, nobody can take their eye off the ball on this. If we again are seen as being cheerleaders for something as strategically catastrophic as that, not just strategically, but in terms of, you know, the suffering of the people in the heartland of Arabia, then I think that would really damage, traditional old school media, perhaps beyond redemption. So, you know, we're trying to be very careful, and I think American media are as well.
What are your thoughts about that, Robert? Because the Huffington Post pointed out, thanks to Bill Moyers, that in the lead-up to the Iraq War, the Post ran 27 editorials, the Washington Post, in favor of the invasion. But this week, it has yet to print any editorials or columns on the issue.
Yeah. Well, you know, nobody likes to go back and admit mistakes. And so I guess I'm not surprised by that. In terms of the lessons learned, though, by the media and others, I think really the place to apply that is with Iran, because since at least, I would say, 2006, the media in general has been extremely skeptical of the claims made by various parties, going back to the Bush administration and others, and then in the Obama administration, very, very skeptical of the idea that we have to go to war against Iran to prevent them from acquiring a nuclear bomb. And I think, you know, it's a maybe somewhat easier call because Iran has been fairly public and open about its nuclear program, and you have a very intrusive IAEA inspection regime in Iran, whereas you really didn't have that with Iraq. However, I guess I would say 10 years later, maybe it's hard to remember how fanatical and intense was the pressure from the White House, from the Pentagon, on everybody in Washington, the media, Congress, and others over Iraq. I just saw a really interesting report on Dick Armey, who was the Republican majority leader in the House at the time, who was a skeptic of the war. And it wasn't until he got a personal briefing from top White House officials saying, it's much worse than you think. Saddam is building suitcase nukes and other kinds of, you know, extreme things, and we have clear evidence of this, that Army reluctantly decided to vote for the war resolution that passed Congress in the fall of 2002. And that was a turning point, the passage of that resolution. And I covered that in Washington. And I'll tell you, people were terrified by the briefings they were getting from the White House and from the military over this. So, yes, it's true that politicians and the media and others, you know, could have been much more questioning. But let's put blame where blame deserves to be, primarily on the neoconservatives who were running the Bush administration team at that point, and the absolutely unprecedented squeeze play that they put on the rest of Washington to get this war accomplished.
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for allowing me this call. I'm really getting frustrated with the tone generally of the conversation of we made mistakes. People were bamboozled. And I don't think it's quite as pretty as that. I think there was a deliberate, conscious effort to get us to war in Iraq. And it had nothing to do with ignorance. It had nothing to do with, it was policy. And now we see the consequence of that policy, which is we see added fuel to our military-industrial complex. We have the boogeyman in Iran. We have Syria imploding, and on it goes. And so, you know, I think we're giving these politicians a free pass, and they can plead ignorance. We plead ignorance, and on it goes. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I want to give kudos to the Center for Public Integrity and the Fund for Independence in Journalism, because they did have a report back in 2008 exposing 935 lies told by the Bush administration. And Martin, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, we've heard several comments from listeners over the years that it's too easy to say that the reporters got bamboozled.
Hey, Ola. Again, I do think that there has been a long and necessary period of reflection in our institution, and I think politically as well. There have been some very good shows on the BBC recently. There was one which I commend to all your listeners at the moment, and that is a panorama show which was on the spies who led us to war and the atmosphere that Washington and London were generating just to make the lies that these spies were telling to them, such fertile material for building a case. There's no doubt that the legacies of the neocons, the legacies of Tony Blair and his administration will never recover from the flimsy case that they made for war, and the fact that there were cheerleaders, certainly within our institution, that did act as enablers during that period. I think that over the past week or so especially, we've seen a settling torch being turned on. These policymakers, the president, the prime minister of the UK, and it's just shown just the gravity of what took place and the fact that it is still playing out a decade later, the fact that the heartland of Arabia still is more unstable than ever, actually, and that the sectarian fault lines that were created when you remove a power base so significant as Saddam's Iraq, all they've done is jeopardize the region for, I would say, decades to come. So, you know, I don't think people that were involved at the time are getting a free pass, and I don't think that people who were perceived to be enablers of this war are getting a free pass either. I think that there's been a lot of introspection that's gone on ever since, and I think it will play out for decades to come.
And Sarhad, before we let you go, joining us from Baghdad, I just wanted to mention the Committee to Protect Journalists put out a new report this week called Iraq War and the News Media. And they point out that at least 150 journalists and 54 media support workers were killed in Iraq from the U.S.-led invasion in March 2003. Final thoughts for you. You're a former Baghdad bureau correspondent for McClatchy. What are you working on today?
Now I am working sometimes when McClatchy reporters come here, of course, I am working with them. But basically, I am not working for the media anymore. However, I follow and I work with correspondent Roy Gutman. The McClatchy is now based in Istanbul. This is basically what I am doing. What he is covering, what we are covering, of course, is the unrest that is taking place in Iraq. Is it at the beginning of division? But I would like, if you can give me a few moments, to give you a small insight into 2003. In February of 2003, I was here in Baghdad. And the general population, believe me, did not know that there was going to be a war.
Mm.
I left the country to visit my sister in Yemen. It is only when I got to Yemen and had access to satellite stations and international news that I said, oh, my God, what is going on?
You know,
we did not realize. We did not know.
You know, Sarhad, it's interesting you say that because we had an unembedded photographer on the show recently, Kyle Thorne, who said he was sitting with Iraqis when Colin Powell was giving the speech about yellowcake uranium. And he said up until that point, Iraqis said there's no possible way we're going to get bombed. But once they saw that Colin Powell speech, that's when the tide shifted and they realized that an invasion was coming.
Yes, of course.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sarhad. And I mean, it's the 10-year anniversary, but we will definitely continue covering Iraq. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you. That is Sarhad Issa, former Baghdad bureau correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. She had an excellent line because she has a journalist's phone, but when we tried to reach Iraqis on Monday, we couldn't because the phone lines are so bad. We are also joined today. Martin Chulov will be joining us for the rest of the hour, Middle East correspondent for The Guardian of London. He has been in Baghdad many times over the years, now based in Beirut, extensively covering Syria. We're also joined by Robert Dreyfus, contributing editor at The Nation magazine, a contributing writer at Mother Jones, and a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. And we are going to talk now about media coverage of President Obama's trip to Israel and the West Bank. And if you followed coverage of this, it got wall-to-wall coverage this week, mostly focusing on the speeches, the photo ops, the chuckles and the handshakes he had with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But where was the substance? What are your thoughts on the coverage that you saw this week on President Obama's trip to Israel? And if there was another story you saw that you'd like to talk about, we would love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Over at Salon.com, Sandy Tolan writes, Obama is missing the real Israel. Turning away from the military occupation of the West Bank is dangerous for all sides. And Martin, you are currently based in Beirut. How is the trip being covered there?
It's been viewed with rather skeptical eyes, as you could imagine. It is being seen as a trip that's skewed very heavily towards the Israeli perspective. There's a lot of reasonably hostile coverage on Lebanese television here, not just the Hezbollah channel, which, as you could imagine, isn't very fond of the visit at all, but certainly all the other television channels here and newspapers. While Lebanon does ostensibly have a free press, it does seem that every TV channel here and every newspaper is owned by a proprietor, and it reflects their worldviews. And almost without exception, the views of the Lebanese media is that the Obama trip is reinforcing the Israeli occupation. It's not providing any solutions, and it paid lip service only to an issue that they do believe is essential to the ongoing intractable peace process there, and that is the continuation of settlements in the West Bank.
And we'll talk about that because the settlements got a lot of media toward the end of his trip. But first, Robert, what do you think was behind the trip? What message do you think the president is sending by making his first trip to Israel? And Mondawis, which is a website that focuses on the Middle East from a what they call a progressive Jewish perspective, said, what is the point of this trip? Quote, he is only there because he's privately promised to go there as part of his outreach to the Israeli lobby. Just my assumption, writes Philip Weiss. It's not as if the media are reporting it. What are your thoughts on that, Robert?
Well, I mean, it is a political pilgrimage. There's no question about that. The president was criticized by some in the Israel lobby for not having gone to Israel in his first term. As we know, that's not that unusual. I don't think President Bush went there until his final year in office. But still, it was a political event that allows Obama to say that he's, you know, got Israel's back, that he's keeping Israel's interests in mind. On the other hand, I don't think we should judge by outward appearances. It's a deadly serious issue. Mm-hmm. First of all, in regard to Iran, I think it helps when the president goes to Israel and makes it clear to the Israeli prime minister that the United States would not look with favor on any Israeli provocation vis-a-vis Iran, such as an independent Israeli strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. And that's a message that Washington has been sending to Israel for about 7 years now. But it helps when it comes in the person of the president. To be charitable, I would say possibly when Obama comes back home, he might very well begin to take up the Israel-Palestine problem again. It's been basically on the shelf since, the days of George Mitchell when Obama appointed former Senator Mitchell as the mediator. But I guess, I don't feel that it's too likely. It's always a safe bet to believe that the United States will not turn any screws on Israel to get them to come to the table. And so, as a result, I think that Netanyahu has been very successful over the past 4 years in changing the subject to Iran. I think he's been making so much noise about Iran for so long that in the U.S.-Israeli relationship, Iran has moved up to numbers 1, 2, and 3, and the Palestinians have pretty much fallen off the radar. That's truly unfortunate.
And what are your thoughts on this question, Martin? And what are your thoughts about just how this was covered in the media? As we were talking about the settlements toward the end of the trip, the New York Times headline this time, no call to halt settlements. Washington Post, Obama eases demands on Israeli settlements. And the Post was one of the few media outlets to point out that since 1967, Israel has built dozens of settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, now home to 560,000 Israelis, an increase of 60,000 since Obama became president.
You know, I think one of the primary aims of this trip was to recalibrate the relationship between Tel Aviv and Washington, which had been perceived throughout Obama's first term as being toxic. You will recall that one of his first trips in his first term was to go to Cairo, and that was to address the Arab world, and that was to reset the relationship with the Arab world post the Iraq and Afghanistan periods, and that was to say that we are no longer going to try and impose our will upon you, but we do think, this is the Obama White House speaking, that you need to take control of your own destiny. And to some extent, that's what he was saying in the speech that he gave yesterday in Jerusalem, when he was saying, yes, you live in a bad neighborhood and there are threats, but you're a strong country and you must make your own decisions and not just seek love and sympathy. And that's the commentary that I'm quoting from Israeli media. But, I think that was a reasonably powerful message and it did resonate. And I guess that gave him room to move in terms of not directly addressing the settlement issue this time. He got nowhere on that in the first term. In fact, he got stared down by Netanyahu, and he blinked. Mm-hmm. This time around, he's saying, you make your own decisions. You've got to be a stakeholder in this, and you've got to be somebody that seizes this moment, because without actually striving for peace, you are alone in a tempest here, and especially with these regional events that are taking place. I mean, if you look at the state of Israel now, I mean, it's number one strategic goal for the last keep its borders safe. If you look around now, Lebanon is anything but safe. The Golan Heights is in play. Egypt is unsafe, and the Israelis truly believe that after Syria, Jordan will be next. And if that's the case, then all of their borders are chronically unsafe, and that is a strategic disaster. So Obama is saying that the Israelis need to make some very difficult and very important decisions and get back on this peace bus by themselves, but without the Americans necessarily, you know, pushing them on the bus and doing the driving.
Mm. And what Obama said was, quote, what was already a pretty tough neighborhood got tougher.
Absolutely, and it is going to get a lot tougher, and that's recognized within Israel. They do understand that. It's not something they're oblivious to, but how to address it, it goes very much to the heart of existential issues for them, and it's something that they need to be very bold and very strategic about dealing with.
And Robert, final thoughts from you. We've got about 30 seconds left. Where do you think this goes from here? Robert?
No.
Go ahead. Did we lose Robert? All right. Well, Martin, sorry about that. I think we're having some phone line problems. What are your final thoughts on this? Where does this go from here?
Well, the region is more volcanic than it's been for a long, long time. I do think we're looking at, you know, some of the most significant issues for the past century that are taking place here. There really is a risk of Syria spiraling right out of control and a deep arc of instability all the way from the Iranian border to Beirut. The Israelis know it. They need to do something about it, but you know, I guess we need to watch this region very intensively and make decisions about whether we need to take a stake in this to manage the outcome or let it just play out organically.
Martin Chulov is Middle East correspondent for The Guardian of London, and Robert Dreyfus is contributing editor at The Nation magazine. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. How can the history of the environmental movement help us understand where we are today? On the next Jour Call, we'll have a conversation with Mark Kitchell, director of the documentary A Fierce Green Fire. From conservation to climate change, the film explores 50 years of the global grassroots environmental movement. So how has activism around these issues changed over the past 50 years? And what's in store for the future of the environmental movement? It's Jour Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Jour Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Jour Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Next time on Music from Other Minds, a site-specific work by John Luther Adams, as well as Symphony No. 3 by Glenn Branca. Join us Fridays at 11 p.m. for Music from Other Minds here on KALW 91.7 FM.
Music from Other Minds tonight at 11, following Voice Box with Chloe Veltman here on Local Public Radio. KALW San Francisco online, KALW.org. 11 o'clock is the time. Stay tuned. BBC's World Have Your Say is next.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say, and you're discussing Cyprus being on the brink of bankruptcy.
It's not fair. They should rethink it. Maybe you made a mistake. Is this the European solidarity? To punish half an island because they, for the first time, somebody said no to them?
The clock is ticking for Cyprus to find 5.8 billion euros in order to unlock a 10 billion euro rescue package for its banks. The deadline is Monday. If not, then all funding is cut, effectively bankrupting the country. Government sources say they are cautiously optimistic that a deal can be done, but say they accept the next few hours will determine our fate. Well, people are frantically withdrawing money from ATMs as banks remain closed, and cash is king as shops refuse to accept credit. We'll hear from Cypriots about how tough life is right now.